if we can define a trial, that is the kind of a trial that appears in the life of a Christian, if we can define it a certain way, then that's what I want to talk about today. First, let's define it, and then we'll define it, then we'll discuss it as I define it. The word is trial. How do we define a trial? Well, this will be somewhat lengthy, but that's because there's a lot to it. If we define a trial this way, a trial is a condition or it's an event. Now, that'd be the first part of the definition. Condition, it's just the way things are. Or it could be an event, something that happens. So a trial is a condition or it's an event that confronts us. In other words, it's not way over there and we're just looking at it through a telescope. It's right here, right, looking at us, face to face, eyeball to eyeball. It confronts us. We can't really avoid it. It's right there. It's in our life. So it's a condition or it's an event that confronts us, but it confronts us in such a way that it will lead to at least one of the four following results. It might lead to all of them, but it confronts us in such a way that it will lead to at least one of the four following results. Number one, it threatens our comfort level. It threatens our comfort level. You might say our overall sense of well-being. Our overall sense of well-being and happiness. It threatens our comfort level. Our overall sense of well-being and happiness. So here we are rocking along in life. The weather's perfect. It's 72 degrees. There's no rain. There's no snow. There's no high wind. It's perfect. We're out in a hammock in the backyard. There aren't any mosquitoes. The birds are singing. I mean, we're just lying there. Everything's good. No pain. Lying in the hammock. Kind of a sense of well-being. We've got a glass of iced tea or lemonade over here. We notice it's getting about halfway empty. And instead of even having to go to the work to go in the house and refill it, somebody comes along and says, "Can I refill your glass?" I mean, everything's good. We're just lying in the hammock. Pretty high sense of well-being. Well, a trial, one of the effects of a trial, it confronts us in such a way that it can threaten that. It can threaten our sense of overall well-being or happiness or our comfort level. And or, I mean, it might do both or all four of these, but at least one of these four. So the second one, it either causes or threatens to cause pain. It either causes or threatens to cause pain. You know, and there are different kinds of pain. Physical pain, psychological pain, emotional pain. But that can be the result of a trial. It either causes or threatens to cause pain of some sort, physical, emotional, or psychological. All right, the third thing that it can do, maybe it does all of these, but it does at least one of them. The third thing, it forces us to make a difficult choice. You know, some choices in life are easy. So you're back in the hammock. Everything's good, just like I said before. Your glass of iced tea is halfway empty. Somebody comes along and says, do you want to finish that? And then I can bring you a glass of lemonade? Or when you finish it, do you want me to refill your iced tea? Now, that's not that hard of a decision. That's not going to cause us too much angst. We get a refill one way or the other. Either beverage is something we like, so I have to decide. Do I want another glass of iced tea or do I want lemonade? That's not a hard decision, probably, for most people. But then other decisions are difficult. A trial can result in us having to make a difficult choice or a difficult decision. And then the fourth thing that can be the result of a trial, it creates uncertainty for us when we desire clarity and certainty. Most of us like to know what the future holds. A trial can create uncertainty. Most of us prefer certainty or clarity about tomorrow or next week or next month or next year, but it might cause a lot of uncertainty. So those are four things that a trial can cause. So if we define a trial that way, it's a condition or it's an event that confronts us in our lives, confronting us in such a way that it does at least one of these four things that I've just mentioned. If we define a trial that way, then I'm going to talk about trials defined that way in this sermon. Now, as defined just now, trials can come in various forms. Not all trials are the same. There are at least three types of trials, three categories of trials, and each one of these is mentioned in the Bible. Not all trials are the same. There are at least three types of trials. One is a test. And we'll look at scriptures that clarify what we mean by that. One type of a trial is a test. A second type of a trial is a temptation. A temptation. And a third type of a trial is time. Just time. The passage of time. And maybe within that you could say time and chance. You notice anything about those three types of trial? They all start with T, don't they? So we're talking about trials. Three categories: test, temptation, and time. So the title of the sermon is The Four T's in the Life of an Overcomer. The overall T, trial. And if the types, there's another T. The types of trial are test, temptation, time, or time and chance. That's what we'll be looking at today. I want to begin by considering two of those three types that I just outlined. Two of those types of trials, tests and temptations. They're not the same. There's quite a difference, really, and the Bible shows us. There's a difference between a test and a temptation. Sometimes people get it confused. Sometimes they don't understand the difference, or they assess a test as a temptation or a temptation as a test. But perhaps we can clarify our thinking a little bit, at least today. No, there is a difference between a test and a temptation. I think the most basic difference between a test and a temptation has to do with, number one, the source. Where does it come from? And number two, the intended outcome or the intended result. Again, I'll try to clarify what I mean by that. If it's a test, the way we're talking about it here and the way the Bible talks about it, its source is God. And its intended outcome is the Christian's success. The test is given so the Christian will succeed. That's the intended outcome. You know, we'll grow, we'll remain strong, we'll succeed. So the source is God. When God tests us, it's when God brings a trial to us, it's a test because it's from Him and He wants the outcome to be our success. He wants us to get a passing grade, not a failing grade. There is a lot of energy around this concept of a test, and it's positive energy, not negative energy. There's an environment or an aura around test, as the Bible describes it, and it's positive, not negative. So if it's a test, the source is God, and the intended result, the hopeful result, is a passing grade, success. The Christian who's being tested, God wants them to succeed, to pass the test successfully. On the other hand, when we contrast that to a temptation, the source is not God. God does not tempt people. The source is somewhere else. It's not God if it's a temptation. And the intended outcome of a temptation is sin. Now, the source is either the devil or our own human nature, which is contrary to God's way, or this evil world. Wherever the temptation comes from, whether it comes from, you know, there's overlap there, obviously, but if it comes from Satan, or this evil world, or our own, the old man, the carnal nature, that's not God bringing the trial. That's this other source bringing the trial. And the intended outcome is that we sin, that we fail. When Satan tempts us, he wants us to sin. He wants us to fail to be faithful to God. When this world tries to draw us in, it's not trying to draw us in so we'll be more like God. It's trying to draw us in so we'll be less like God. So we'll sin and be separated from God. Human nature, the old man. It says the flesh, the old man, lusts against the spirit. It's at war against the spirit and vice versa, the spirit against the flesh. When the old man, the old way of thinking, the carnal nature puts thoughts or promotes thoughts, it's not that we'll be more righteous, it's that we'll sin. A carnal mind is enmity against God. It's not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. It's all about sin. All right, so the difference between a test and a temptation is the source and the intended outcome. If it's from God, it's a test, and He wants us to pass the test to succeed. He wants our faith to prevail. He wants to give a passing grade. That's why He does it. He doesn't do it so that we'll fail. He does it so we'll succeed. These other three sources, the devil, the world, the old man, puts out thoughts and inclinations, And the intention is that we sin. Now, both of these are trials, two of the three types of trials. Depending on the context, we can determine which it is. And I want to get into a little bit of language with you, translation. Sometimes there are some translation problems with our English Bibles that can make a person misidentify whether it's a test or it's a trial, what its source is. And it has to do with language and translation. There were two major words or families of words that the apostles used to talk about trials in the New Testament. Two Greek words or closely related families of words. One of them is sort of a multi-purpose word. We have multi-purpose words in English that you have to know the context and know what it means. It can mean different things. The word bear, that can be a big old animal in the woods that'll kill you. It could mean that, a bear. But bear could also mean to carry a weight, bear a burden. So you have to see the context, how the word bear is used, to know really what it's talking about. Same with Greek. There are Greek words that are multi-purpose words, and they can mean, depending on the context, very different things. So the apostles used one of those words. It sometimes gets translated trial. It sometimes gets translated tempt or temptation. It sometimes gets translated test or testing. And sometimes it gets translated in a way that leads people astray because it's not as maybe the translation wasn't as accurate as it should have been. So I want to show you some examples of what I'm talking about. So in reading the Bible, here's the point. In reading the Bible in English translation, sometimes we can go off on a slightly wrong tangent, thinking something's a test when it's a temptation, or thinking something's a temptation when it's a test, just because of the way the words are translated into English. But that's not only true of reading the Bible, that's true of just our lives. Sometimes we know we're in a trial, but we might make the mistake of misidentifying which kind of a trial it is. Some people blame everything on God, and some people blame everything on the devil. Everything that's a trial, they think, well, the devil did that or was involved. Sometimes the devil has nothing to do with it. Or that it's all from God directly. Well, sometimes God doesn't have anything directly to do with it. And so we want to not make the mistake when we read the Bible, and we want to not make the mistake when we live life of mislabeling different types of trials. Again, for reasons that will become very clear as we go through it, I hope. Now, one of these words that the apostles used to talk about trials has a number associated with it. I'll pronounce it once. But for the rest of the sermon, I'm going to refer to it as a number. It's just easier that way. It's the Strong's number. Bible scholars often refer to Strong's number, the Strong's Concordance. Every word in the Bible, both in Hebrew and Greek, has a number attached to it. And a man named Strong came up with this enumeration. And then all the other lexicons, just about any other Bible reference works, it refers back to Strong's numbers. Everybody's using the same numbers. Well, this one word is pronounced parazo. You'll probably forget that as soon as I do, but parazo. But the number is the key. I'm going to refer to the number. It's 3985. We'll talk a lot about 3985 in this sermon. It's Strong's number 3985. Or, as I say, the next door neighbor to 3985. Maybe it's 3986. Why? Because sometimes a Greek word is in the verb form, and sometimes it's in an adjective form, and sometimes it's in a noun form, and each of those will have its own number. So, but it's 3985 and it's close neighbors. Let's put it that way. Parazo. Now, this is one of these multi-purpose words. It's a word that can be translated as either a test or a temptation. Here's what the lexicons say with regard to number 3985. The first definition, to test. Comes right out and calls it a test. To scrutinize. That just means to examine. To prove or to approve. We're testing something so that we can approve it. Not so that it will fail. We're showing the validity of it or the worth of it or the value of it. So it means that all those things, to test, to scrutinize, to prove or to approve, passing grade. Or it could also mean just to examine. So those are positive things. So if God 3985 is a Christian, and it is that kind of a 3985, a test, an approval, or an examination for the purpose of approving, the Christian should reply or respond in one way. When God's testing us for the purpose of perfecting us or approving us, we shouldn't resist it. We shouldn't feel negative toward it. We shouldn't push back against it. We should humbly yield to it. When God is doing the testing, we get again the picture of a potter in a clay. And he's done some work on this lump of clay, and it looks pretty much like the desired end result, but it's not perfect yet. So he'll hold it up and he'll scrutinize it. And maybe he'll have a measuring device to be sure that the angle is just what he wants. And what if it's not? Well, then he can change it so that he can approve it. The purpose of the examination of the test is to perfect. That's the thing. That's a positive dynamic that we should have in mind. So the clay should not resist or push back or resent or engage in self-pity and complaining about this. This is a positive thing, and it leads to good results. But the same word, 3985, in other contexts means something else. And in other contexts, it can be properly translated to entice to do evil. Well, that's a temptation. The same word can also be correctly translated to entice to do evil, to tempt to do evil. Same word. It's like in English, the word bear can mean two very different things, to carry something or a big hairy animal. Same with number 3985. So when 3985 appears, the translators into English have to decide which way they're going to translate it. And I would say, as I study this, most times they get it exactly right because the context leads them that way. Sometimes I don't think they got it exactly right, and then it can lead to misunderstanding, which we'll see. So that was one word that the apostles used to talk about trials. Sometimes it refers to tests. Sometimes it refers to temptation. But there is another Greek word, an altogether different Greek word. And in this case, it always means test. It never means temptation. So we'll study some places where that word appears. That's a different number. 1383. So the other number was 3985. Well, this is 1383. So we'll refer to 1383 on a number of occasions. I'll pronounce it once. Dokimion, but from now on it's 1383 and its close neighbors, 1383. You look into the lexicons, this is translated testing for the purpose of coming to an opinion, specifically the opinion of approval. So it's testing with an intent, the intention of coming to an opinion. And what is that opinion? Approval. It's not a negative thing. The desire is to get this lined up, this test, to get whatever is being assessed or tested so it can be approved. Passing grade, check mark, move on to the next grade. That's the purpose of it. Testing for the purpose of coming to an opinion of approval. Now that particular word, 1383, only appears twice in the New Testament. So we're going to look at those two times here in just a minute, and we'll see clearly God is behind it. This is a testing, not a temptation. It's a trial, but it's a testing trial. Before I go to those two places, again, just want to mention, sometimes to outward appearance, the one sort of trial might appear to be the other sort of trial. And why is that such a big deal? Because of what I already said. If it's a test, if it's God as the potter perfecting the clay should not push back, resent, resist what's going on in that trial. The proper response is humble acceptance, yielding to it. But if it's a temptation, the Christian should reply and respond exactly to the opposite, should push back with all his might and with the help of God. Resist it, not give in to it. Now, if we've misidentified the kind of trial, can you see we might respond incorrectly? Now let's go to these two times when 1383 is used. It's only used twice. First place is in the first chapter of James. James is one of the scholars tell us, and there's internal evidence, one of the earlier books written in the New Testament. This was the half-brother of Jesus, we believe. And this was written early on. James 1. So even early on in the history of the church, here an apostle is talking about trials. And it turns out in this setting that both of those words were used. Both 3985 and 1383. So we have to be careful how we understand what's being written. But let's look at it. It's in James, the first chapter, and I want to look at the second, third, and fourth verses 2 through 4. My brethren, count it all joy. Take note of that. The context is the response to whatever is about to happen should be joy. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Now I said earlier, not all trials are the same. There are different types of trials. Right there is an indication there's different kinds of trials. In fact, the word various, it's translated various. It's the Greek word poikilos, and that's what it means, different kinds of. That literally is what it means, different kinds of. So we already are seeing biblical evidence. There's different kinds of trials. But which one is he focusing on? Which kind? My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various or different kinds of trials. What is that trial? What's the word for trial there? You only got two numbers to pick from. In this case, 3985 and its neighbor, 3986. That's the word trial. Various kinds of trials, the word is 3985. But which meaning is it? Is it a test from God? Or is it a temptation from the devil, from human nature, or from the world? Well, we have to read on to be sure. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials, 3985. That's the overall word. It could mean either kind. But let's read on. Knowing that the testing, 1383, the testing, the proving, the assessing, for the purpose of approving, for the purpose of coming to the opinion of approval, a passing grade. That's what all that means. That's the 1383. The testing of your faith produces patience. God is involved in this kind of trial. It's one of the kinds of trials. But it's for the purpose of assessing the quality and giving a passing grade, strengthening, perfecting faith, our relationship with God. The testing, the 1383, of your faith produces patience. The end result is a good thing, not a bad thing. This is a positive thing. That's why we can rejoice. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete. The context is God perfecting us, the potter perfecting the piece of pottery. Positive, not negative. That you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Now, 1 Peter was written much later, apparently, than James. If James is one of the earliest books written in the New Testament, 1 Peter would have been one of the later ones, near the end of Peter's life. Let's go to 1 Peter and see the second use of this word, 1383. This is 1 Peter chapter 1, and we'll look at verses 6 through 8. It would seem on the surface that Peter has gotten a hold of a copy of the book of James. I mean, the thought flow here is virtually identical to what we just read. Even some of the wording in the Greek language is virtually identical to what James. So I don't know that for 100% certainty, but it's possible that Peter had a copy of the book of James when he wrote this. It starts the same way, doesn't it? 1 Peter 1:6. There's rejoicing involved. In this you greatly rejoice. Though now, for a little while, it need be, you have been grieved by various trials. Those are the same Greek words that were used back in James. Various is poikilos, and again it means different kinds of, and trials is again the 3985 word. It's almost a transcription or a virtual copy of what we saw in James. But again, what's the point of it? What's the purpose of it? Verse 7, that the genuineness of your faith, to prove that our faith is good and it passes the test and it's acceptable. It's a positive thing. That the genuineness of your faith, it's the purpose of this trial, to give a passing grade, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested, and there it is, 1383. That's the second time in the Bible 1383 is used, only the second time. So it starts out using the generic word that could mean any kind of trial, the 3985, but now it narrows it down to the 1383. God's involved in this. The purpose of the test, the purpose of the trial, is to perfect the faith, that the genuineness of your faith, God can examine your faith and give you a passing grade. Then verse may be found to praise and honor and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen you love. Again, a positive environment around this word. Though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory. Now I want to go back at this point. Those are the only two times that 1383 are used. Other times, the related words, maybe the noun version or the adjective version, but those are the only times that form of the word is used, and we just look at them, and it's clearly that God is perfecting as a potter the work of his hand, and the faith and the relationship between the Christian who's being tested and assessed, the purpose of it is to give them a passing grade, to approve it. If some slight corrections need to be made, that's a good thing. I want to go back to James chapter 1 and read some verses we didn't read the first time that follow what we did read. Let's go back to James 1 and look at verses 12 through 14. So you see, inherent in both of those passages, the proper response to this kind of a trial is joy, is patience. It's not resistance. It's not anger. It's not self-pity. It's not moaning or complaining. But this is a good thing because a good and necessary thing is happening, and God is doing it. Yeah, it's a trial. It does one of those four things. It either threatens our comfort level, or maybe we're too comfortable. Maybe our comfort level needs to be threatened, or it causes real or threatened pain, or it does those other things. It causes us to make a difficult decision. Maybe our faith will only be perfected if we start doing something differently than we have been. We've got to make a difficult choice, or it can create uncertainty. If our faith has been in one thing and this testing has shown us that that's not where faith should be, then we're going to have to make a correction. And that might not be easy. All right, so, but let's go back and now look at verses 12 through 14 of James 1. Blessed is the man who endures temptation. Now here's what I was saying earlier. Sometimes the way this all-purpose word, that's the word 3985, it can mean two very different things, a testing from God or a temptation from the devil or human nature or the world. In this case, they chose to translate it as temptation. Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, and that's back to 1383, 4, and 5, he will receive the crown of life, that's a good result, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is 3985, not in this context, let no one accuse God of tempting. No, God is testing. Let no one say when he is 3985, I am 3985 by God. In that sense of 3985, God doesn't do that. He doesn't tempt us with the intended result that we sin and we fail. God never does that, as it says right here. Let no one say when he's 3985 in that sense of 3985. Well, God's doing that. God is doing that. I'm 3985 by God in that sense of the word. God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself 3985 anyone. Well, he tests people, but he doesn't tempt people. So it might have been a little clearer when we go back to verse 12 if it had said, blessed is the man who endures trial. Because it wouldn't have gotten us off on the pathway of thinking this is talking about temptations of the devil. What follows is that it's not talking about that, it's talking about testing. It might have been a little clearer, blessed is the man who endures trials. Or, blessed is the man who endures tests. The rest of the passage shows that it's God himself doing it. God doesn't tempt. So let's never make the mistake of accusing God of tempting us when really God is testing us. Or let's never make the mistake of accusing God of tempting us when it's the devil or our own human nature or this world that's tempting us. God does not do that. And then in verse 14, he couldn't make it any clearer, could he? Each one is 3985 in the sense of a temptation when he is drawn away from God. God would never do anything that would lead us astray from him. Each one is 3985 in that sense when he is drawn away from God or from obedience to God by his own desires. That's the source. It's not God, it's human nature, his own desires, the flesh, the old man. That's what causes the negative sense of 3985, a temptation. He's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. He's enticed to sin and do evil things against God. So God tests, yes. He scrutinizes, he examines, he assesses the quality. The purpose is for a passing grade, for our faith to be affirmed, to be approved, for the purpose of perfecting us and increasing our reliance on him, for the purpose of advancing our completeness. That's what we get from these scriptures. But our own nature, on the other hand, influenced by this world and Satan, it tempts us to be drawn into sin, into doubts about God's goodness, into doubts about can God be depended on. It tempts us to rely upon ourselves and not God. It tempts us to reject God's love and to just do our own thing. God never tempts us and draws us in that direction. So God does the one thing, testing, a lot. He does the other thing, tempting, never. Never. So the understanding we need to have is when a trial is in the form of a test, and God is in it, and God's intended result is our good and our strengthening, we should not resist it, resent it, complain about it, fight it, or get angry about it. On the other hand, when a trial is a temptation, we should fight it with all our strength and with the strength of God in us. Two very different responses. Now, let's, with that background, look at some other places where these same words are used, and it'll even enrich our understanding of what's going on here. Let's go to Luke 14. And we'll look at verse 19. Luke 14 and verse 19. This isn't about trials or anything that we've been talking about, but it's about the use of that word. That word. That's test. That's where the kind of trial where God's involved. The 1383 word. And it's close relatives. So Luke 14 and verse 19, a man has bought some oxen for the purpose of farm labor, pull a plow. But he first is going to test them, assess how well they will operate. That's what it says here. Another said, I bought five yoke of oxen and I'm going to test them. 1381. He's going to assess them in order to come to an opinion about them. And the entire intended result is that they will be proved to be successful. He wants them to be a successful yoke. So I ask you to have me excused. Some other translations, how that very verse is translated in some other translations. One says to prove them. Another one's to try them out. Sometimes when God, when a trial comes to us from God, God's trying us out. He's trying out our faith. He's giving it a test drive to see how well it performs. To try them out. That's the contemporary English version. Another version, God's word, to see how well they do, not how well they don't do. Again, there's positive energy and thoughts around this word 1383. It's to see how well they do. The purpose is a positive one, to come to an opinion that they are exactly what I want them to be. They are in a passing grade. That's a success. Let's go to another place, 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Verse 8. So 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 8. So here's Paul. He's been giving some directions to the church at Corinth, and then he tells them what his motive was. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 8. I speak not by commandment, but I am testing. I'm 1381-ing you. I'm testing the sincerity of your love by the diligence of others. He's finding out how real their love was. He's assessing it. He wants to come to a good conclusion. He's given their love a test run. He's given them something to do, a test drive. He wants them to succeed. That's 1381. Let's go to another place. There's several we'll look at. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. So when, and to the degree we understand this, when God tests us, it is a trial. I mean, it's we're not rocking in the hammock anymore. It's going to be something that does one of those four things. But our reaction to it, both the apostles James and Peter said, it should actually be a joy, because we know a wonderful process is going on. It might not be comfortable, but it's a good thing. So, all right, so 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 21, very simply. 1381, all things, and hold fast what is good. And again, the purpose is to find good things that pass. So we have a lot of spiritual signals coming our way in this life. We should put them to the test and assess them and let the good ones in, but leave the bad ones out. We should filter them. But the purpose is to hold on to what's good. 1381, all these influences, in an attempt to find out what's good and we can hold on to. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. We'll become 1381 experts today. 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 13. Now, if you go to work on Monday and start talking about 1381, you're going to get a lot of strange looks, I'm pretty sure, from your coworkers. So maybe you can think it and not say it. But 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 13. Each one's work. This is talking about how God judges us in our final fate. Each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire. It'll get hot. This is a test that it involves heat. And the fire will test. It'll 1381. Each one's work of what sort it is. So we extend the potter and the clay analogy. All right, so the form is now, right? But it's still clay. It's beautiful. It's perfect. But it can even be made more beautiful and more perfect if it's not clay, but ceramic or fired clay, pottery. It's gone through a real heat process. And it'll be hot for a while, but in the end, the product will be much more beautiful and durable and even more pleasing to God. So sometimes God takes our faith or our love for a test drive, and it can get pretty hot for a while. But the intended result is a good thing. It might be a test drive through the oven, you know, of a test. But the purpose is not to make us fail, it's to make us more perfect. All right, well, we're in 1 Corinthians. Let's go to later in the book, chapter 16. Well, I was going to give you some other translations of that verse we just looked at in chapter 3. Some other translations, it's to try every man's work or to determine what kind of work, determine the quality. So some of the trials that we have that are tests from God are assessing the quality. You can pick up two pieces of metal. One might be real gold and one might be something else that's not, but it looks. So what do? Put it in fire and refine it, and the real object will react to fire differently than fool's gold or false gold. All right, so we go to chapter 16 and verse 3. This really makes it obvious that this word means not only coming to an opinion about, but the desired opinion is approval. Paul says to the church leaders there, I want you to select somebody that is trustworthy, that you approve, and then when I'm there, they'll help me take this offering to the Jerusalem saints. Verse 3 of 1 Corinthians 16, and when I come, whomever you, 1381, by your letters, I will send to bear your gift. So the leaders have assessed the dependability and the trustworthiness of various members of the congregation, and the ones that pass the test, that pass the 1381, they're approved. Those whom you, 1381, that you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem. One other translation calls this, those whom you accredit. So our faith and our love can be accredited. I remember once we went through an accreditation process at the universities that I've worked in. The process is kind of tedious, and it can take a while, and there's some heat involved. But it all leads to a stamp of approval from the accrediting agency. All right, so a couple more. 1 John chapter 4. Again, the idea is we have many influences trying to get into our mind and our belief system and our heart. And we should 1381 of those. We should test them and only hold on to the good ones and reject anything that doesn't glorify God. So that's what it says here, 1 John 4 and verse 1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but 1381 the spirits, whether they are of God. And I find it interesting. He could have said to find out the ones that are not of God. I mean, that would have worked. But around 1381 is the notion of coming to a positive passing grade. So he says to find out the ones that are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. And then back to 1 Thessalonians, there a minute ago, chapter 2 and verse 4. But as we have been 1381 by God, we've been approved by God, we've passed the test, as we have been 1381 by God, approved to be entrusted with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God who 1381's our heart. So he 1381 our heart, and the result was we got 1381, we got approved. Two different uses of the verb form of this word. Now, with all that as background, now let's go to John 6. I don't think we could go here first. We had to see all that other. But now let's go to John chapter 6, and we'll look at, this is the Gospel of John, John 6, verses 4 through 6. John 6, verses 4 through 6. Now, the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" He asks a question of one of his disciples, later an apostle. He asks him a question. He was 1381-ing Philip, but the word is not 1381. He was testing Philip. He was asking a question. He wasn't tempting him. He was testing him. But it's not 1381. In this case, it's 3985. So here is a case where the 3985 should be translated and is tested. It would be kind of silly. This he did to tempt him. No, he was testing him. He was wanting to see if Philip had the faith and the understanding to know the answer. Where should we buy bread? This he said to 3985 him, but the kind of 3985 that's not a temptation, but is a test. Hoping that Philip would get the right answer. And if he didn't, he'd show him the right answer. For he himself knew what he would do. So that's an instance of where 3985 is used. It's clear that it means test and not temptation. The case back in James, as I referred to already, maybe it would have been a little clearer if they had translated it just trial or test instead of temptation, because God never does that. And then we'll go to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11. Verse 17. This is the faith chapter. We've already seen that oftentimes the intended result, the purpose of a test, is to approve our faith. See that it passes muster and that it's acceptable to God. Look at this. Hebrews 11, verse 17. The father of the faithful. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, was he tempting Abraham? Hoping that Abraham would sin when he said, sacrifice your son, your only son, Isaac. He was testing him. He was assessing the quality of Abraham's faith, hoping that he would pass it, and he did. But the word is 3985. By faith, Abraham, when he was 3985 by God, offered up Isaac. It's 3985 in the sense of a test. And he passed it. And that was the desired result. And it was the actual result. When he was 3985, he did offer up Isaac. He was willing to. The knife was on the way down. And he who had received the promise offered up his only begotten son. So we've been focusing on tests, 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 God's involvement. And our proper response is to yield humbly to it, even though it has one of those or all of those four results. It's a good thing. It will have a good result. So the clay shouldn't be mad at the potter when he gets put into the oven. It's going to make it more durable and lead to something even more perfect. But what about temptations? Let's now turn our attention to that kind of a trial, temptations. The author is not God of a temptation. Instead, it's Satan or our old nature or this present evil world. Its intention is not the strengthening of our faith, but our failure, our sin, to get us to compromise with what we know to be true and godly. The purpose of a temptation, from whichever three of those sources it comes from, Satan, the world, or human nature, you could say there's some overlap, its goal is our failure. Its goal is us coming to the conclusion that God simply can't be trusted, it's just too hard, it's too much trouble, it's not worth it. That's the desired outcome of a temptation from its source. And the classic example, probably you've already thought of it, Matthew chapter 4. Verse 1. Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be 3985'd by the devil. That's who was tempting him, trying to get him to do things that would not be pleasing to God. So that's 3985. That's not a test, that's a temptation. Because the source of that trial was Satan trying to get Christ to disobey or do something displeasing to the Father. Same word, 3985. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15. Hebrews 4 and verse 15. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points 3985 as we are, yet without sin. Satan put all kinds of temptations before Christ. The world resisted Christ. They tried to trick him. They tried to get him to stumble all over his words so he would make a mistake. And yet he never gave in to it. It says he never sinned. That was a temptation, but he never sinned. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. Chapter 10. Let's look at verse. This is an extended passage. We'll start in verse 1. 1 Corinthians 10, we'll start in verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized unto Moses. They all had the same experiences. Most of them didn't pass it very well. They all ate the same spiritual food. They all drank the same spiritual drink. They drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. What did most of them do? They sinned. Almost all of them, you can think of everybody from time to time except Christ, but I mean, most of them quit following God. Very few exceptions. Moses, Joshua, Aaron for the most part, Caleb for the most part, that we know it. But most went the other direction in their hearts. These things became our examples. This is verse 6. To the intent that we should not lust after other things. So they were being tried, but were they being tested or tempted? What was the desired outcome? The expected outcome from the source. Lust, evil things, idolatry. Do not become idolaters. They refused to push back against the temptation that was presented to them. In one case, a king hired a religious person to entice them with the women of a country to commit a fornication or adultery. They had a natural heart that went toward idolatry. They were tempted, and most of them did what the temptation was hoping it would do, and that is they sinned. They lusted after evil things. We're not to become idolaters, as for some of them. As is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play, nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did. One day 23,000 fell, nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents, nor complain, as some of them also complained. They had a natural, ungrateful, unappreciative nature. They're the only nation that God had ever selected to be led by Him personally, and they complained about everything. Now, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation, 39:85, that kind of a trial from human nature or from the devil or from this world, has overtaken you except as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be 39:85 beyond what you're able. But with the 39:85 will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. These are temptations. Their source is not God. God did not bring all those Amalekite or Midianite women into the camp of Israel. God did not put in their hearts a desire to have idols in place of Him. God did not put in their hearts a complaining spirit that even this miracle food that He gave them, they would begin to complain about. So the context of this trial, that they did what the trial was intended to do, they sinned, that's the context of this statement, that God will not allow you to be tempted, 39:85, beyond what you're able, but will, with the temptation, also make the way of escape. Is it the case that some temptations are just so great that they overpower everybody of necessity? And the answer is no. If we stay close to God, if we use the power of God's Holy Spirit, we can resist them. We can fight back against them. We don't have to give in to them. Now, when we do, it's because we haven't been close enough to God. We've let our hearts drift, just like them. That was the purpose of having this recorded. The source of all this that's being described here was their lusts, their inclination to put things in their lives above God, their ungrateful, self-centered, complaining human nature, and most of them didn't push back against that, and they sinned. But God said in that context, the power is available to overcome those things. All right, so we spent most of our time up to this point in talking about two of the three types of trials, tests and temptation, but there's a third one I mentioned at the start, and that is time, just the passage of time, or time and chance. There are literally things that just happen. They're random. They just happen. Not because God has specifically engineered a particular test drive for our faith or our love. It's just part of living in this world. Things happen. You're walking down the road. You're on a road, and maybe you're just looking straight ahead or you're talking to somebody, and there's a rut or a pothole or something, and you just happen to step in it and twist your ankle. Did God put that hole in the road? Now, some people would blame everything on God. No, it just happened. You know, it's just part of living in this world where things like that can happen. But that is that's a trial. It can cause pain or all those other things. And then the aspect of time that's getting old. You know, when you get up in age, you have more aches and pains just by virtue of the fact that your body's wearing out. as presently constituted, we don't have bodies that were intended to last forever. And time, passage of time, the wearing out of our physical bodies, the diminishing of our physical energy, those things, that just happens. That's part of living in the flesh. It can be a trial. It can be unpleasant. Just getting old, the difficulties that go along with getting old, aches and pains that we either didn't used to have or they didn't used to bother us as much, loss of energy, loss of enthusiasm, loss through death of friends or loved ones, or just simply being in the wrong place when a calamity strikes, and it does strike. Ecclesiastes 9. I believe it would be a mistake to say God specifically put that pothole in there and took our attention away so that we stepped in it and twisted our ankle. And I wouldn't even go so far as to say the devil did it. It just happened. It's time. It's time and chance. It's living in a world where we're susceptible to that sort of thing happening. But Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 11, I returned and saw under the sun, the race is not to the swift. Well, it ought to be. Yeah, but sometimes, I've told you many times over the years, the example of Jim Ryan, he was the fastest runner, he didn't win the race. He got tripped up. It was just an accident. He tripped in the Olympic trials or whatever, in the trials for the finals there in Mexico City, I believe it was, and he fell. He was the fastest runner. He didn't win the race. It just happened. Did God make him trip? Did the devil make him trip? It happened. It was an accident. There are accidents, and sometimes people suffer. That can be a trial. It is a type of trial. So the race is not always to the swift. It usually is, but not always. Nor the battle to the strong. There have been battles in world history where there's a strong army and a weak army. Guess who won the battle the next day? The weak army. Why? Oh, any number of reasons. Maybe the night before, the strong army were so confident they all got drunk. They weren't battle worthy the next day. That can happen. It has happened. Give those two armies 10 opportunities to face up against one another. 9 times out of 10, the strong one's going to win. But something can happen. And maybe a disease or a virus or something just goes through the one camp and not the other. And the weak army could win. These things happen. So the battle isn't always to the strong. It usually is, but not always. Nor bread to the wise. Shouldn't the wisest people make the most money in this world? Do they? The Bible has the example of the wise poor man who saved a city. And as soon as it was over, they all started taking credit for the wisdom that he gave them to save the city. And they shuttled him back off into the corner of poverty. He should have been the best paid person in the city. He saved the city, but he wasn't. Nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happens to them all. There is some randomness living in this physical world. And it can be a trial if it confronts us directly. Job chapter 5. As I've said before, not everything that Job said, and in fact, not everything that Job's 3 friends said, should we reject as being untrue. Some of their conclusions were incorrect, but let's look at Job 5 and verse 7. I think this is correct. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. In this life, time and chance is, on occasion, is going to find almost all of us. Not that God engineered the test specifically for us with our name on it or anything else. It just happened. Spark, like sparks flying upward. Job, later in chapter 14. Man who is born of woman is of few days and full of trouble. Well, you might say, that's kind of a negative outlook on life. But it does happen. Our physical human bodies, our physical lives, are not currently engineered to last forever. Life is a process of slow death. You might say, well, that's kind of negative. Well, that's kind of biblical, too. That's what God told Adam. Dying, you shall die. And that, from the moment we're born, we're gradually dying until we finally die. In this life, Our physical human bodies are not intended to last forever. They wear out. It's appointed unto all men to die once. The temporary physical life is a long, drawn-out death process. Dying, you shall die. That may not be something we think about very much, but when you get older, you do. So from birth to the first death, it's a process of controlled dying. It doesn't mean there can't be pleasures along the way and happiness along the way. There can be. But that's the big picture. Along the way, from birth to the first death, time and chance happens to them all. Now, you know, sometimes that can be positive. Sometimes we catch a break. I'll tell you the same story that I told them up there in the morning. The first time I was ever able to have a tailor-made suit. My mother wanted to give me a present at some point. So she sent me to a tailor. I got a tailor-made suit. And this tailor was just one of these talkers. He would not stop talking. So I tuned him out most of the day. He's taking the measurements. He's just talking the whole time. And so one thing I heard him say, I tuned in. He says, you know, everybody gets one good break in life. I just got mine. Well, what's that mean? Well, he had this little shop where he had his tailor business. And he said just recently, he says, I'm about to move. If a year from now you want me to measure you for another suit, you have to go somewhere else because I'm moving. Well, why are you moving? Because some fool came along and he wanted my building so bad. He wanted this real estate so bad. He asked me how much I'd sell it for. Well, I didn't want to sell it. It's my business. So I know this is. He was talking the whole time. I was listening to this part of his story because he caught my attention. He said, I know what this is worth. Call it X. He knew. Call it $100,000. Just making it. So the guy says, what do you sell it for? I said, I'll sell it to you for 10X. I'll sell it to you for $1 million. Not expecting for one moment the guy would do it. The guy says, who do I make the check out to? He got a windfall, time and chance. Somebody just wanted that building so bad he paid 10 times what it was worth. A windfall, time and chance. Sometimes you might get one. Your long-lost Uncle Louie, you even didn't even know existed, leaves money in his will to you. That's time and chance. You couldn't have seen that come. And yet, now you're thinking, I'm seeing the wheels turning. I wonder when my turn is for that positive windfall. It can happen. But more often, doesn't it kind of go the other direction? It doesn't usually go the other direction. So on some occasions, we catch a break. We get an unexpected windfall. That's kind of time and chance. But on other occasions, and it's probably most other occasions, it goes the other direction. Unexpected difficulties. They just find us like sparks flying up out of a fire. Unexpected difficulties confront us without us seeing a direct or clear cause and effect relationship with anything. It just happened. It seems like nothing directly caused it. We kind of got in the way and it found us. Well, that's the third type of trial, just time and chance. Or getting old and having to face our mortality. That is a trial. What's the godly response to that one? To trust God to see you through it. It doesn't matter how hot it is, how unpleasant it is. Sometimes God will see you around that trial, time and chance, and sometimes he will see you through it. And we just have to trust God. I think the prayer is like the prayer Jesus said. Is there any other way? Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. So if we're faced with a time and chance thing that's either negative already or going to be negative, it certainly wouldn't be wrong to ask God, deliver us from this. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. If some purpose can be served that God sees is important, then to trust him through it instead of around it. Now, if we're capable of drawing back at arm's length from this third type of trial that I've tried to illustrate here, either time getting old or time and chance, if we're capable of drawing back at arm's length, even when it affects us directly, and to be objective about it, I think even then we can see good. We can see a cause to rejoice. Good or potential good. And here's what I mean. Let's go back to being in the hammock. Perfect weather, perfect conditions, nothing threatening us, 72 degrees, bottomless iced tea or lemonade glasses, birds are singing, it's all good. Is it possible in this life that we could get just a little too comfortable in the hammock and say, I want this to go on forever. We're not meant to go on forever in the hammock. You know, we're like caterpillars, but God wants us to become butterflies. What if the life of a caterpillar was so pleasant he just wanted to stay a worm and didn't want to be resurrected into the God family? Is it possible that if we didn't suddenly get smacked up the side of the head by time and chance, that we'd get just a little too comfortable in the hammock? We'd like this life a little bit too much. We'd want it to go on just a little bit too long. We'd grab hold of it with a death grip, pardon the pun, and we just wouldn't want to let go of it? Answer for yourself. I think the answer is yes. If this life for you and me really were such a trouble-free and pleasurable and smooth ride, would we ever want to get off the train? But we weren't intended to be on this train forever. We weren't intended to stay caterpillars. We were intended to become butterflies. And one is vastly superior to the other. So even then, if we're capable of looking at it that way, we can see good. Maybe we shouldn't be all that comfortable or grasping a hold of this world, this life, and its pleasures. The hammock ride. It might get a little too comfortable. For, Philippians chapter 1. I think that's what Paul is talking about here. Philippians chapter 1. And verse 23. What he's talking about is living a little bit longer in this life or dying. That was the thing he was talking about here. He says, I'm hard-pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Being a butterfly is way better than being a worm, a caterpillar. Being in the kingdom of God in a life that will no longer even be subject to trials of any of those three categories is way better than clinging to comfort in this life. Hebrews chapter 11. He said it's way better, much better. Well, sometimes the imperfections and the time and chance difficulty trials that we have might help us just to remember that. There's something much better than even the best state of being a worm. Hebrews 11. I mean, the best state of being a worm does not compare to being a butterfly. Hebrews 11, verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on this earth. They knew they weren't intended to stay in that hammock the whole time and just drink iced tea. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland, and truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they'd come out, they would have had opportunity to return. If their undivided attention was on how good it was in the hammock, they might never have another thought about the kingdom of God. They might just want to stay where they are. They wouldn't pray, thy kingdom come. They like where they are now. And so time and chance trials sometimes help us remember that. So maybe by pure chance, a bird flies overhead that had a nut in its beak and it drops it and hits you right on the head as you're lying in there in a hammock. Time and chance. Maybe it helps you conclude, maybe I shouldn't be in the hammock. Maybe that's not the best there is. Maybe there's something better. They desire a heavenly country. Verse 16. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, just time, getting older, we become more aware that that's happening. Yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. That's what's important. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, because if our soul focuses on what is seen, we may not be looking at anything else that's more important. We not look at things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. The things which are seen are temporary. They're subject to time and chance. They're subject to all kinds of trials and suffering. But the things which are not seen are eternal. the butterfly stage of things, there are no more trials of any kind. There's no more testing. There's no more tempting. And there's no more time and chance. The kingdom of God is a trial-free zone, a trial-free life. Revelation chapter 7 says that. Revelation 7 and verse 14. So I said to him, "Sir, you know." So he said to me, "These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them." This is at the butterfly level of existence, never to go back to being a worm or to be tried in any way. "They shall neither hunger anymore, nor thirst anymore. The sun shall not strike them, nor any heat. For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living waters, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." It's a trial-free, eternal level of existence. Way better than the best life of a worm. Revelation 21, verse 3. "And I heard a loud voice," 21:3, "from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying.'" These are the results of these types of trials. There won't be any more of that. "No more pain. The former things," the kind of a life where trials visit you, "the former things have passed away. Then he who sat on the throne said, 'Behold, I make all things new.' And he said, 'Write, for these words are true and faithful.'" He said, "It's done. I'm the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I'll be his God, and he'll be my son." So the seemingly random unpleasantries of this life, time and chance, they should have the effect of convincing us to strive for something better when there won't be any more trials of any kind. And that's the kingdom of God, putting it first. So some concluding thoughts. We've looked at three types of trials. With the help of God's Holy Spirit, the people of God can pass tests. That's what you do to a test, you pass it. They can resist temptation. That's what you do to a temptation, you fight against it, you resist it. And they can endure time and chance, the vicissitudes of time and chance. They can do all three. Trials will not defeat the people of God, no type of trial, but instead will help prepare them for the kingdom of God, will help them to pass tests, resist temptations, and endure the vicissitudes of time and chance. So the last passage we'll look at, Romans 8, verse 35, wraps it up way better than we could. So we'll just use these words to wrap it up. Romans 8, verse 35. "Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation," that's a kind of a trial, "or distress," same comment, "persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, sword? As it is written, 'For your sake we're killed all day long. We're accounted as sheep for the slaughter.'" Seems like our lives are full of trials of one kind or another. "Yet in these things we're more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that none of those things, life or death, angels or principalities or powers, things present or things to come, nor height nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord."